Hey everybody, this is Alex Merced, and this is another podcast. It's been a while since I have recorded a podcast episode, so here I am. And this podcast is going to be a topic I've done, I think, once or twice in the past, but I think it's always good to revisit and rediscuss. And I'm going to be starting doing mainly much more economic-focused posts going forward, a lot less political commentary. Definitely economics I find much more interesting to talk about these days. Politics has just kind of gotten, I don't know, it's basically the world has become such a mess these days that I find I'm more interested in understanding the world again than like when I was originally super passionate about economics, than I'm necessarily as interested in affecting it as much. Mainly because I think there's just a certain inertia for certain things at the moment that are just going to have to play out. And, you know, basically, there's a certain level of slowing down the inertia that's necessary, but most of that's going to have to deal with just sort of educating people and modeling our behavior. So less than through necessarily like policy actions. You still need people involved in the policy discussion, because if not, then people just do what they want. But it's just not where my passion is at the moment. So what I want to talk about is the Austrian business cycle theory, and just sort of like, again, redefining it, what it is, just so you understand. Like, this is a theory from the Austrian School of Economics, and if you're not familiar with the Austrian School and what a school of economics is, a school of economic thought is essentially, the way I like to think about it, is they're like the gangs of economics, in the sense that, like, can imagine, like, you imagine like West Side Story has like the sharks and the jets. You know, in economics, you have like the Austrians, the monetarists, the Keynesians. And essentially what they do is they have different approaches to methodology, philosophically, to what the purpose of economics is, to what's possible, all sorts of different differences. But the idea is that there's just like these sort of different groups of economic professionals that just sort of have a different approach to things. And they oftentimes feel like their different views are in conflict, and they end up in having sort of like economic battles through, you know, academic journals, where someone will write an academic, you know, an article, and then someone will write like a scathing response and go back and forth. Or in the comments of a blog post on their economics blog. So that's essentially what, like, you know, the more cynical view of what a school of economic thought is. But the Austrian School of Economic Thought really started with Karl Menger. I think it was from the Vienna School. It's been a while. Okay, but essentially, one of the Karl Menger's really big insights was just that, like, value is subjective. The idea is that, like, things don't have an intrinsic value, because, if there was an absolute value to something, there would really be no transactions, because then there would be, obviously, one side of a transaction would be worth more than the other. Because value is subjective, we can have transactions, because, you know, the reason why I would exchange money for a good with you is because I value the thing you have more than the money that I have, and you value the money that I have more than the thing you have. And that allows there to be sort of like this movement of value and goods. And once you realize that, then basically what's happening is that, like, it changes the way sort of you think about a lot of things, because if you just start thinking like some things are just have some sort of absolute intrinsic value, it causes you to kind of create like a lot of judgment statements and creates a lot of different weird paradoxes in economics that don't make sense in that world. Because why would someone choose to do something less, want to buy something less valuable, or invest money in something less valuable? It's because you're assuming that there's just you're basically imposing sort of your value propositions on the population, on everybody else, on everybody else's behavior. And then that can be, you know, very difficult to reconcile. So essentially from like an Austrian economics point of view, it's just that, like, it's not that people are irrational or rational. It's just that people are making decisions based on their what they perceive to be the most valuable option within the certain circumstances. Okay, doesn't necessarily mean like I love my choices, but of the choices I have, this is the choice that is the best under the circumstances. Okay, because oftentimes we're like, why don't people do this? Well, X, Y, and Z. Like, there, you know, there's some they all exist within this perfect context where every option was available to them. Okay. But that's just sort of like, you know, where the Austrian school got started, and then it kind of you have people like Jürgen von Bauwerk and talking about like the nature of like time and interest and also really 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 cool stuff I'm not going to get into right now. But bottom line is you eventually get to the Austrian business cycle theory, which primarily is going to be the work of the likes of like Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, Murray Rothbard, who all, you know, wrote extensively on this topic. And the idea here is trying to understand sort of like the business cycle and how you look at the business cycle, what causes the business cycle. And essentially one way to kind of think about it, I always like to use the allegory of the lottery winner as a way of understanding sort of like the overall high level concept of the Austrian business cycle theory. So what happens to like someone who wins a lottery? So what happens if they have like this sudden surge of money? Like, you know, maybe let's say I'm making $50,000 a year, and then suddenly I buy a lottery ticket. And now I've won $1 million. So what happens is that you suddenly have this like surge of money. And what happens is because for a variety of reasons, but what happens to the lottery winner? Oftentimes they just end up spending it lavishly. Like they don't really know invest it in a way that so it's not that they use the money, because the problem isn't that you use the money, is that you use the money in ways that weren't necessarily as productive as they thought they would be. So oftentimes, like the lottery winner ends up making, you know, investing in businesses of their family and friends, instead of like really doing like hardcore analysis. But at the end, because of the surge of money, it results in a certain behavior, a certain inability to do good economic calculation that results in a bust. Later on, they run out of money. Okay, and this is sort of like this reassessment. Like a lot of the things they bought are probably not going to be worth a lot less than they thought they were going to be. They're not, basically, their whole lifestyle becomes unsustainable because of this sort of surge. Okay, the actual business cycle theory gets a little bit more complicated, but I mean that's essentially one way you can kind of think about it. There's a surge, the surge of resources of perceived resources, really, because again, when you have $1 million, you think you have all this stuff, but if you overpay for things, you know, you automatically use things up. You may end up thinking, oh, I have a lot less than I actually have. You know, you end up in this worse situation afterwards. But really what happens in the economy is you end up having some sort of surge of the monetary supply, okay? Which may or may not have an effect on interest rates. But what happens is that the surge of the money supply will typically have a downward pressure on the interest rates. And again, this doesn't mean an increase in the money supply. It just means like, let's say an increase of dollars, an increase of whatever. Which doesn't necessarily mean that there's more actual resources in the world. It doesn't necessarily mean like, you know, there's more wood, there's more doctors, there's more whatever. So what happens is that a sudden surge of money causes interest rates to go lower, which makes certain business plans will suddenly become more viable than they were otherwise. And a really good example of this is I always like to think about like after 2008, interest rates went really low. When interest rates were low, what happens is that the rate, basically the way when you take out a loan as a business, you don't think about like, oh, okay, I'm paying this much interest. You think about what your monthly outlay is for the to maintain the debt versus the eventually monthly revenue. So basically, hey, if I have to pay $500 a month to maintain this loan, but I can build this thing that's going to make me 800 bucks. Okay, and this is seems kind of similar to like when you think with like buying a house or something like that. You know, then this is totally worth it. Okay, I'm pocketing the $300 difference. And that's but what's going to happen is that the thing that factors in that first number, so that $500 I have to pay to maintain the loan, that becomes smaller as interest rates go down, because again, there's two parts to a loan, principal and interest. So there's the part that represents the money that I borrowed, and then the percentage interest that I'm paying on top of it that factors into that sort of monthly payment for the loan. So, for example, if I have a business enter, if I have a business idea, but right now at current interest rates, it would cost me $600 a month to maintain the loan, but I only expect $550 a month in revenue from the business, then that business is right now currently not viable. Like the financing costs too much relative to the enterprise's revenue generating capability. But then what happens? Interest rates go down, and now the cost to maintain that loan would be $500. And you know I'm making five I perceive that I'll make 550 in revenue. Suddenly now this business idea makes a lot more sense. Okay, and that on its face may be the case. Like basically, hey, this makes sense. But the problem is If it goes down like too low, let's say, the cost of the loan now goes down to 400 and I can make 550 of revenue. Chances are not only doesn't look like a good idea to me, but maybe it looks like a good idea to a lot of people. Okay, so generally some sector, somewhere, this is like this opportunity that just like looks too good to be true. And everyone gets the same idea generally at the same time. It's not that they weren't looking to invest the money. It's just the change in interest rates just made this look too good, whether it's like investing in houses. Right after 2008, a lot of it was like investing in drilling for oil. You had like this surge because you had this like huge spike in gas and oil prices. You had really low interest rates. So everyone was like, okay, I'm gonna go drill for oil. Okay, and everyone borrowed a lot of money because you're thinking, okay, well, the cost of the money is cheap and the price to sell the oil is high. This makes a lot of sense. And if you were the only one doing it, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But when everyone else is doing it, what happens is that everyone's now buying all the inputs, okay, the capital goods to go drill all the oil, which is you're creating like the surge of increase in those underlying resources, which is going to drive up those prices. This surge of economic activity means jobs for a lot of people. So in the short run, it feels like, hey, things are really good economically, because there's all this money moving around, because all these companies that are selling like the raw goods, they're doing better, they're hiring people. These companies are getting a bunch of investment, so they're hiring people, and now everyone's consuming, and that's causing more jobs. It's just this whole sort of virtuous cycle. But then what happens when everyone finishes making those oil wells, per se, or finish building those houses, or coming out with a bunch of redundant dot-com companies and so forth? Well, what happens is that, like in this case, like the with oil prices went down, and a lot of oil companies ended up, getting wiped out. It wasn't that one wasn't quite like a big bust, but it's like a mini version of the same idea that happened like a little bit after like 2008. I just remember like I worked in training people in finance, and I just kind of remember seeing a lot of these people like running into this issue. But then what happens is that because everyone brings oil to the market at the same time, the value of the oil becomes a lot less. And then you'll probably end up because everyone was buying the same sort of inputs, the price of those inputs went up. So the cost of the enterprise, even though your interest rates were low, the cost of doing the enterprise probably went up. So you end up spending a lot more than you thought if you had, or you just ended up not having being able to borrow enough to actually complete the project, depending on whether you got there first or last. But then the sudden surge of oil to the market, price goes down. The business, what happens is that for a lot of those entrants, that business isn't as viable as it was before. Okay, so what's going to happen is that maybe some of them will be successful. Some people may, have worked on a trim plan on a smaller margin and they're fine. Some people maybe may have not planned quite as carefully. They're going to go out of business. New entrants will stop coming in and looking for investment for that particular enterprise. So suddenly those particular capital goods that were suddenly previously in high demand started going down. So you're seeing, people losing their job. You're not seeing quite the same level of expansion in that area. And it's not like everyone's just going to completely just shift gears and start investing in other areas right away. So now you have this sort of gap that's kind of like the bust, where essentially like you have too much of it's. And again, it's not overinvestment. Like that's a mistake a lot of people make when they're thinking about this. It's not that people invested too much. It's malinvestment. They put the money in the wrong place because the signals were wrong, because of that original sort of surge in the money supply caused that low interest rate that made this particular sort of sector suddenly make a sudden surge of economic viability. And everyone's like, oh, okay. And then the bust is just kind of like when the economy realizes, like, well, we put the money in the wrong place. So now these businesses are not viable. They're going to have to go through a liquidation process, which doesn't happen. Businesses don't go out of business overnight. And just because your business is not viable, meaning you shut the doors the minute you realize that, a lot of people will fight to keep their businesses for a long time. And then that's when the bust happens. Okay, so those unviable businesses theoretically need to go out. Those resources need to get, because basically their level of debt relative to the revenue of their enterprises is out of whack. They do need to go bankrupt. But when they go bankrupt, it doesn't necessarily mean those resources just disappear. They would get resold to somebody else in the process for a lot cheaper price, for a lot less debt, to the point where that asset is now viable again. Okay, you overall will probably still have a lesser dollar value of assets in the economy as things get revalued, but basically, instead of like people trying to struggle to take on more debt to try to maintain that existing business, they would, reallocate it to someone who can operate it at a profit because they're not going to have that same debt overhang from before as those enterprises liquidate. and may not necessarily have to fire people, because if people liquidate earlier, the other person who suddenly bought it at a cheap price, at its, I wouldn't say true value, but at a more sensible valuation, again, may not have the same kind of debt against it and be able to maintain the enterprise as is. Okay, it would just, the enterprise would have to change hands of someone who has less of that debt overhang. So you again, so you need to reallocate these resources, and which then frees up, resources, because then you don't have these people who are just trying to like. But generally, what happens is that people get scared. They're scared that like, hey, if we just like let everyone go out of business, everyone's just going to lose their job. And to an extent, that happens. A lot of times, people before they decide, hey, it's time for me to close my door, like time for me like to sell the business and get out. They'll cut costs as much as they can, trying to make this viable. But again, there's only so much of that that can happen, and which is why if you take a look at like the recession of 1920, which you don't hear, but James Grant wrote a great book on this. But why like that recovered so quickly? I mean, you allowed resources to sort of redeploy. There wasn't so much intervention. Typically, what does end up happening is that governments intervene because you're trying to, this is where you start getting to that Keynesian playbook where they're more concerned with protecting the jobs that exist oftentimes. They're like, oh, because they're concerned about the overall consumption power today. So their policy prescriptions are based on the idea of like, how do we maintain that? Like, they're asking a different question. They're saying, like, how do I maintain this level of demand that I have at this moment? So yeah, if you throw money at the problem, prevent business from going out of business, those people still have jobs and they'll still keep consuming. But you haven't necessarily cured the fundamental problem, the malinvestment. That's those businesses are still not, they're like, let's say debt to profit ratios are still, or debt to revenue, isn't gonna suddenly just make sense. Even if they get to exist another year or two and keep those people employed for another year or two. So you can do that and you can maintain that, but you're not addressing the like the more bigger like structural concern. And maybe theoretically, oh, then why don't you just like pay down their debts? You could do that, but that's going to cause all sorts of miscalculation as well, because that people factor in previous policy choices. So if people realize, the what's called moral hazard. So you factor in like, oh, well, if we take on too much debt and there's a systemic problem, the government may pay down the debts, then people will factor that. That gets factored in future decision making. Which can affect future sort of bad decision making. It becomes a bad signal that affects the economy. And it's not that the economy is the only economy can only work if there's perfect signals, but you make enough bad signals, you have consequences. So that's essentially the idea. Again, the idea is that there's a sudden surge of money. It's going to lower, have a downward pressure on interest rates. Not again. Nowhere have I mentioned inflation. Nowhere have I talked about price, like the overall price level going up. So it's not necessarily measurable through inflation, although likely you'd see some inflation of prices, but it's an inflation of the money supply that causes the lower interest rates that changes the way people invest. Doesn't change whether they do or don't invest. It just changes how they invest, whether they invest in something more prudent or invest in things with a little bit more risk because of that perceived reward. And then what happens that causes this sort of collision of mismatch of sort of values and debts and that need to be liquidated, and if they're liquidated, things will recover. If they're, that liquidation is postponed, things get kind of sluggish because, and that's why you can have these like really long, drawn out like recoveries that are like really meandering because you're not having like this sort of, quick sort of reallocation of things. And then there's and it's not like there isn't a cost. Again, everything is a trade-off. In economics, everything is a trade-off. Looking at this sort of from a, I'm trying to like abstract from like my own personal normative views. But there is like a trade-off theoretically in the sense that like, hey, if you pull off the band-aid, for some people that pulling off the band-aid, the people who are li on the liquidation side of things, that may be so severe that it has, impacts on their neighborhoods, on different neighborhoods where crime may increase, people might commit suicide, also to these like sort of, possible economic concerns. But again, if you drag it out and create things that are like and broaden that sort of pain across, you can still have that same situation, but in different places for a different period of time. That can happen either way. But it's oftentimes that human concern that sometimes, when something makes sense overall, like, oh yeah, okay, I kind of see what you're saying, Alex. If we redeploy these resources, and they're in the hands of somebody who has like less, less of that debt service relative to the revenue of the enterprise, suddenly like those things can be productive for the economy again. I feel really bad for that person who has to liquidate, and what happens to them and their family and their community, and what happened, all these other factors that happen. And that's oftentimes where people just feel like, okay, well, time to intervene. And again, if your question is how to maintain a enterprise running, you can throw money at it and it'll stay running in the short run. Keeping things running in the long run is a much more difficult question. And that's oftentimes the big difference between different schools of economic thought. They're asking different questions. So that's why when you get into like an argument with people with different economic thoughts, like they look at each other like they're dumbfounded because they're completely prioritizing different questions. So they're arguing different points, but they're all assuming that we're all asking the same question and that we're all trying to solve the same problem. And that oftentimes is where I see like people disagree. So hopefully you guys enjoyed that. My name's Alex Merced. Again, join my Slack community. That's generally, if you want to get in touch with me, that's where you'll find me. You can find that at alexmerced.com. Just go to alexmerced.com and it's, let me see, it should be called the Merced Slack. It's right there at alexmerced.com. You can find the link and join. And I'm thinking of maybe like doing the occasional like economics meetup chat in there with with Slack's huddle feature. So you guys are all, that's it. I'll see y'all later. I'll probably try to record another podcast here and there. So keep subscribing. I will start be doing like more regular like YouTube shorts on YouTube. So that's youtube.com/AlexMerced. Follow me on Twitter, at Alex Merced, and have a great day.